Welcome to The Line, the sports podcast from PR Week.
Welcome to The Line, the seventh episode of the PR Week sports podcast. I'm Richard Gillis. I'm here, as ever, with Danny Rogers, the editor-in-chief of PR Week. Welcome, Danny.
Hi, Rich. How are you doing?
I'm okay, actually. Yeah.
Coping with the festive slump of Tottenham Hotspur.
Yeah, we're now in seventh place. Chelsea fans crowing to my left. We're talking today about agencies, and we've got two people I've known for a very long time. And when I first met them, they were the sort of bright young things of the agency world, of the sports marketing agency world.
Not
anymore. So we have Henry Chappell, founding partner of Pitch Marketing Group. Welcome, Henry.
Hi.
And we have Rupert Pratt, co-founder of Snack Gaming and founder of Generate. So we've got a lot of founders in the room today.
Very impressive.
Very impressive. Henry, let's start with you. Pitch Marketing Group, just give us a little bit of backstory. So just tell us where it started. What was the market like when you first went to work in this space?
So the backstory starts really with my career, I guess. My first real job in the sports industry was at IMG, which is International Management Group, the world's leading sports management group. My first paid job was actually selling.
You're not contractually, you're not obliged to have to say that now.
No, it's okay. But actually, my first start was actually selling fanzines outside Old Trafford when I was at university, and I made very good money doing that, which actually was football fanzines were the first form of social media, actually. We can come on to that.
Discuss.
But that's another conversation, perhaps. But I started that. I worked at IMG.
You'll have to explain to you'll have to explain to both of us what it was like being in publishing when it was a profitable.
Well, it was someone didn't rob your money at the end of the game, which sometimes happened. But we made really good money. It was the fanzine was set up by a guy called Andy Mitten, who's still a journalist today and very successful. And United We Stand Still is going as one of the most successful fanzines in this country. But it paid my way at university to follow my team, Manchester United. But I then came to London and I was lucky enough to get a job. And this shows my age in the fax operating room of IMG. And this is in the day where anything of note was faxed. So I spent a year reading the contractual details for everybody from Michael Schumacher to Nick Faldo to Tim Henman, who was flying high at that time. So it was a great learning curve. I probably wasn't supposed to be reading the fax. I was probably just supposed to be sending them, but I did learn a bit. But then, so I started my career there. IMG were the sort of monopoly player in the sports industry at that time. This is mid-90s, so it was the 80s, 90s. They'd really dominated and world-renowned. But I realized you weren't really going to progress there because there were a lot of fat cats with Mercedes-Benz cars and big leather chairs, and they weren't going anywhere. So I was lucky enough to get a job at Freud Communications, which was about 40 people when I joined, and was a crazy, dysfunctional, but very creative, hectic environment.
Some would say it still is.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I wouldn't comment. But I worked there for 6 or 7 years, and I had an amazing experience, because what happened there as a 20-year-old, you were exposed to some very big clients and sort of put into bat, way up higher up the order than you ought to have been. But, that was just the way it was. And it was very much a sink or swim. And it was a great experience. And I think Freud's at that point was at its actually pinnacle and was trading off its connections, its connectivity, its the fact that it had access to everybody and everything. And I think in those days, back to the point of agency, that was critical. But one of the things I learned in that process was the importance of ownership if you're in the agency game. And that's why I had an eye on setting up my own agency. And really, out of my two experiences probably three experiences out of United We Stand, but particularly IMG and Freud's, was why I created Pitch. And I talked to, Matthew Freud was an investor in the business at the outset, and I just talked to them at length about it, because all I'd identified as a 28-year-old was basically that sport, engaged consumers like nothing else. Even then, football was still, people were still sort of looking down the nose at it, but I realized the popularity of it, the consumption of sport was on the increase, both in terms of viewership and participation. And brands were realizing this and were investing in it significantly. And I just felt that there was a, in those days, the big PR agencies might have had some sports expertise, but it might have just been one bloke with a jumper in the corner. And the traditional sports management agencies like IMG were very traditional and big. And I felt there was a need for a specialist agency in with the communications space that had expertise, you know, distinctive, defined expertise in the sports industry. And that's the premise for Pitch PR, as it was.
And would you still say you're a PR company?
No, we're definitely not a PR company now. And we're trying to, but not that we don't think PR's good. It's great to be, we have a very successful PR division and we've got some very long-standing brands and sports rights holders that we do PR work for. You know, the NBA has been a client of Pitch's across Europe for 10 years, and we are their European, you know, communications agency and have helped build the NBA across 7 key markets. You know, we've worked with BT, out and out PR, since to launch BT Sport in this country. Very, very successful investment for them, and that's out and out PR. The list could go on. So PR is still a really important part of our business. But, you know, we also, the reason for the rebrand to Pitch Marketing Group was because of the other areas that we work in, and sponsorship, both strategy and activation, obviously content creation and content production, but also ambitions elsewhere. And we increasingly have brands we're working with in a purely digital capacity. So it could be odd when you're pitching to Tag Heuer to work with them on their sponsorship at the Premier League to be pitching as Pitch PR, because, you know, you needed to be. So we don't really want the entry point to be a particular expertise. We wanted it to be the brand as a whole, because I think the evolution of agencies, and this will come to the point.
Well, park that.
I'm jumping ahead.
You are. No, but exactly where we want to go. But okay. I want to ask Rupert the same question, so we then get to the same sort of timeline. So Rupert, because I remember you from Sport Business.
Yeah.
The hallowed, where we met. It's the university, really, of the sports business.
Yeah, it was also,
some would say.
Back to the publishing argument, it was doing a great job of burning lots of venture capital.
That was my job, wasn't it? I was the editor.
At the time. It was burning money rather than making it, but yeah, I mean there's some similarities to Henry's story. Very much started out, I guess, at the birth of the sports marketing industry, back when sponsorship was primarily the chairman's whim, you know, and then as the industry grew, people realised that they needed specialists. So I sort of went from working for a one-man band that was sort of just managing sponsorships as a one-man consultancy, to then into Sport Business, you know, the magazine, and the industry was growing. There was obviously a requirement for insight, expertise, as more and more investment was coming into the marketplace. So back with a guy called Andy Muggleton, who we met at Sport Business.
Well, whatever happened to him?
He's still working very hard, effectively realised that there was an opportunity in the marketplace, probably in the second or third tier, beyond the primary first tier rights, because there was value everywhere. You know, second tier rights had value to them, so we started out primarily selling rights.
And that was Generate.
That was Generate, and then, you know, we found, I suppose, a niche for ourselves in being able to understand and package up second, third tier rights, because everybody has an audience and a passion point, and it didn't matter whether we were selling beach volleyball or superbikes or second tier motorsport. There was eyeballs, there was value to it, and then the business grew. We would do a deal, and then the sponsor would say, "Well, can you manage this for us?" So we started doing more consultancy and activation, and then much like Henry, the next alliteration was, well, we need to activate these rights. So we started up a PR department, and then into event management. So the agency grew to a team of specialists, but our specialism was sport. Latterly, we sold that back in April last year to Mission Marketing PLC. And rebranded as Mongoose Sports and Entertainment, and integrated that business. So, and I guess over time, you know, the business has changed. But I guess the objectives that we deliver haven't, you know, and the way in which we go about achieving those has just changed. So it's, you know, we deal in passion points and engagement, but it's just a case of new tools and new channels. So
okay, so we're sort of up to date. Henry, I interrupted you in terms of the direction of travel for agencies.
It's more competitive than ever. That's definitely the case. I think there's probably more opportunity, but it's more competitive because you can trade in a number of different areas, which is against why we've sort of broadened our proposition, which is more in line with the type of work that we do. But we have found we're competing with such a wide array of businesses, and we're not just competing with agencies. I think nowadays you compete with your client, because increasingly they have more and more in-house expertise, and so obviously with procurement-driven processes and the like, they try and do more and more in-house. So you might have a client you've worked with many years, but you're competing with them for the actual work. And secondly, we're competing with media platforms, for, you know, whether it be specialist ones like, I don't know, a Copa 90 or 90 Min, you know, or Goal or Perform, you know, who are media platforms and have deals with brands who then say, we can do it all, because obviously they want to own the client, right up to Facebook.
Yeah.
You know, on the big brands that we work with, we're all in the room together, but they're sort of basically, they would like to own the whole thing. And I think also with the leading sports right holders, if you ever work with Manchester United, they actively try and keep the agencies of their sponsors out of the room, actively, because they don't want them involved. Because they'll say, you know, you're spending the money with us, we've got our own capabilities to activate this and deliver this. And so you sort of, the competition is incredibly broad. And so, you know, we won't come and talk more broad about the sports industry, but for agencies, you have lots of situations where are they friend or foe? So, and that's why we really crystallize what our role is, because I think we have to be really clear to customers, to your clients, in what the value for us is.
What is that value?
Well, we're trying to keep it real simple, and WorkKeepers still believe the role of agencies is ideas, is great ideas. Because you can be spending a ton of money on Facebook and they can support and all the rest of it, and they might understand the algorithms and all the rest of it, but still, at the heart of it, you need great ideas. And I think that's what marketing agencies should be, you know, consumer marketing agencies, and it should be trading on, and the abilities. And I think that's ultimately, you speak to most clients, that's still what they're looking for at all levels, whether it be a PR client or a sponsorship client or a brand line. They're looking for great ideas, something that could, because they all their challenge is share of voice, is getting attention. It's so competitive for them out there that they need great ideas to cut through. And that's what we're really trying to focus, building a creative business, if you like, which is just around great ideas that can then be delivered across different lines of business or channel, whether I say it be PR or sponsorship or content or whatever it is. And that's what we're really trying to focus on.
So I was going to ask you whether an idea means that you then have to run the campaign itself, or doesn't that really matter?
No, I mean, I'll give you an example for a campaign we did for Diageo. We created for Captain Morgan a campaign called Celebrate Like the Captain, which is based around football culture, actually, about the, you know, when do you most behave like, I don't know if you know the character Captain Morgan, the brand, but when do you most behave like Captain Morgan?
I'm aware of it.
Probably when you score a goal. You know, you let your inhibitions go and you punch the air, or maybe even you twirl your shirt around your head, etc. So that, based on it, is that they love that insight. And so we did a sort of user-generated content campaign to get people to send in entries of them celebrating like the captain, and then their team that they play for, based on the fact like a million people still play football every Saturday, Sunday, and then probably go for a drink afterwards. The winning team will win a VIP trip to Jamaica to the home of Captain Morgan. That was our idea. Diageo loved it, bought it, but then different specialist agencies, I think Gravity Road did the social, and I can't remember what ad agency did the creative, and then we all had to play nicely, but it was our idea. I think we still did the PR. Obviously you'd like to do the whole thing, and this is back to the point of being more competitive, but you had to settle for, we got a really good fee for developing the idea and for doing
this is the point, isn't it? Because how do you charge for an idea? This has been one of the big challenges of advertising and PR, in that if you're not running the campaign and therefore running it on a time spent basis, you have to have the right fee for the size of the idea.
Who owns that idea as well? And just to pick up on one of Henry's points, or your question indeed, is, you know, to look to the future, or even to look at the now, you've got to slightly look at the past. And you know, Henry talked about, the role that they play. And I think in addition, you have to offer a specialism, an expertise. As an agency, you, back to the in-house argument or the fact that we're competing is more competitive, you have to offer an expertise or specialism that either the client can't do in-house or to some degree the other agencies in the roster can't. And if you look back at how, you know, certainly from we were in the industry at the beginning, sponsorship and sports marketing was a specialism 20 years ago.
It's not now. That's
so,
the key point.
So to look
Everyone knows about it.
So to look back, you know, when we started, it was, you know, you were brought in as the specialist, but sort of the market's gone through more consolidation. Media houses, the media groups of which we're sat in one now, they all have their sports marketing teams. The mainstream PR agencies have a sports department. So the industry got generalised, I would say,
yes,
which then made it more competitive. And that's not to say some of the generalists, some of those guys have got really good specialisms within within Havas. You know, they've got, or the guys at Mongoose are specialists at sport, fitness, PR. Pitch do a fantastic job at sports, PR, content distribution, whatever you want to call it. And that's because we understand the marketplace to a level and a detail that maybe some of the generalists don't.
You know, creativity needs a process, and it needs, you know, a real methodology. So it's not, it isn't just, I thought of this in the shower this morning. Yeah. It needs to be much more professionally organized. And I think if you can get clients to understand that, then they can put more value on it, because then they can understand that the time that goes into the creation of an idea. And I think your point you raised a minute ago is if that is one area, obviously, because there are other areas, this is the one we've identified, probably in the creative side of things, because you know you could pick up other points of expertise around data or tech expertise, and that could be something, some sort of technology expertise. And I think in our world, sports, I say Two Circles has done very well, haven't they, breaking through with sort of some market leading thoughts around CRM and the use of data applied to sports rights holders. So I'm talking about this sort of applying to brands, really, yeah, and also sports rights holders and what have you. But I think what we're trying to do is take that further, that thinking further, how we could create the ideas all around, so that clients can understand it. If they understand that process more, then you're going to put more of a value to it.
But is it also understanding the impact of those ideas? Because it's all very well the client understanding the process. Surely they've got to understand the impact.
Yeah. You'd want to be paid on output. I mean, like, you know, I think if we would look to get paid on the end result, a success, a percentage on the end result.
Or the likely impact of a particular idea.
Yeah, exactly. The actual percentage of the end result. So I think that's the ideal situation for us or something, is that then if there is a bonus payment or some form of payment mechanism based on the actual business impact at the end. You know, and then you sort of up front about it. In the middle, you might it's elbows out about who does exactly what, and you might sometimes get to do the lot, and sometimes just to do one channel. But that's all good. But that you have to accept. There's always going to be, you know, you're always going to be one of a number of snakes in the pit. You know, when it comes to trying to get the work for all any brand of any note, aren't they? Because they'll all have a media agency and a creative agency and a digital agency and a, you know, so you're all going to be in there in amongst it, trying to get your fair share. But I think where you can really win is ownership of the idea. But I do think all agencies, we all need to think about how we can not undersell that. Because
the ad agencies have got this fundamental problem, which is that they've always been very good at coming up with great ideas, and they've made their money by taking a cut of the media. Now it's more difficult to take a cut of the media because that's being disintermediated. Yeah. So how do the ad agencies charge for their big ideas? And they've been very good at this sort of thing. So it's content is a new format now, isn't it? And how you value that is very tricky.
Yeah, just on your content thing, this is one of my bugbears within the industry, is that everyone talks about content marketing, content distribution and content creation. It's the emperor's new clothes, isn't it? You know, define content to me. Well, content is words, pictures, video, right? Well, back in the start of our industry, you know, we did content distribution. You know, we used to get stories written on behalf of brands. We'd get pictures placed. We'd get people speaking and talking about a brand or a campaign. But back to the idea and the creativity, that's something that's never diminished. But it has to be, the idea is the thing that opens the door for you. That idea still needs to be, that creative concept still needs to be applied. And it just happens to be that the way that we need to apply that and distribute that content has fundamentally changed now.
What I was going to say, just as you were saying, you reminded me of your old sort of agency, IMG, in terms of the way in which that's evolved with something like UFC. So they've made a... It's not about ideas, it's about ownership, though.
Yeah.
It's about creating intellectual property that they can then commercialize. And then all the other services that they've always offered are doing that, so in terms of selling it. Is that... You know, that's real top-of-the-market stuff going on there. It's very expensive. But is that a model that is attractive to all... Can all agencies borrow from that, do you think?
Well,
I don't know. I think they're a very, very different type of agency, aren't they? So it's more of they're a media agency. They're an owner of sports rights, aren't they? And so that, but their model was always, going back to sort of golf, was to try and where they made most money was they owned the whole lot. So if they did the World Match Play Golf at Wentworth, you know, it was exclusively their golfers. It was their tournament. Yeah. They sold the hospitality. They sold the sponsorship. They sold the broadcast rights. And I think probably had a 50-50 joint venture on that too. You know, so
which is exactly the same model as the McGregor.
Yes.
McGregor and Mayweather fight. Essentially had all the hallmarks of an old McCormack deal, didn't it? They own the talent, they own the event, they own the, you know, and so everything then flowed ultimately back to them.
And I think it's not just in sport, it's across sport and entertainment. It's a Simon Cowell model. It's the business model. You create the property and own the whole lot is when you absolutely hit the jackpot. But we're talking about, you know, rights agencies.
It comes back to your point about the idea and Rupert's point about who owns the idea in terms of, you know, for example, switching saddles, great idea.
Yeah.
Is that something that was ownable or was that something?
Well, I think it's probably not, because it was a one-off. Perhaps we're doing a second one with Betfair. We've come up with the Rio Ferdinand defended to contender, you know, ding, ding, round one in January, I think. Well, maybe a bit later, but we'll see. But an idea like the Wembley Cup, perhaps, which Havas created, or Poke, I can't remember who. Yeah. Everyone, success has many fathers, doesn't it? You know, it wasn't pitch, unfortunately. But I do look at that jealousy. But that's a good idea, because that's something that's going to continue, you know, forevermore. So probably it was #United and, you know, Spencer who came up with it. I'm not sure who actually owns that idea. That's an example of a great idea.
Yeah.
That if agency should be, that's how I think you can get ownership. I think it has to be something that continues year on year.
Well, if you look at Coca-Cola, they've always seen assets in three ways. One is your traditional official partnership rights, FIFA and IOC. And then you've got something like a trophy tour, which is a sort of collaboration. There's a hybrid between FIFA and Coke, and there's an ownership share there. And then you've also got the owned events at one end, which...
Yeah, I think to look at the... You know, we're talking about the role of agencies, you know, and I think you've got to look at the market that we're operating in now, because traditionally agencies have always sat in the middle. And the way I've always seen the market is agencies have sat in the middle of a triangle, you know, ultimately, in terms of sports marketing agencies. You know, you've got the sponsor advertiser sat at the top of the triangle, and you've got rights holders trying to access that sponsor advertiser, and you've got broadcasters and publishers. And then the agency sort of sat in the middle of them via whatever route, bringing those two parties together, activating the rights, whatever it might be, advising the sponsor on what to sponsor. But I think, interestingly, that the world has changed significantly now to the point where nobody really, and this is probably why we're grappling with this issue, is nobody understands what their role is anymore. Because ultimately, rights holders want to become broadcasters. You know, they now realise that the new gold is about content distribution, even though that's what they used to do was broadcast content.
So that's an OTT argument,
yeah. Yeah, and so they're trying to, they know that sponsors, advertisers need to want more content, and they want social media content, and they want that distributing. So they're turning into almost, you know, rights holders are turning into mini content distribution teams. You know, ECB. Building a content team now, and the likes, and then on top of that, you've got broadcasters and publishers that are predominantly probably trying to become rights owners to some degree, because they need more means of monetizing their audience. But then latterly, you've got the digital players, which will come on to the Amazons and the Facebooks. So that triangle has now become a bit more of a square. And now everyone's sort of trying to become a, I guess, a digital publisher or a content distributor. And so the industry doesn't actually really understand who's what anymore.
Doesn't really understand the pattern of its own existence.
Correct. And everyone's trying to get everyone for lunch. And then you've got the agency sat in the middle. So to Henry's point, what used to be quite a simple exercise in PR, which was, I've just got to get my client in the media, as in the press and on TV. Now, you've got to get your client across 20, 30, 50 different channels, across different formats. And actually, what's my role in that? Am I distributing it? Am I giving it to other people to distribute?
Yeah.
And the story goes on. So I think that's the bit that the agency world needs to wrestle to the ground.
That's the inherent difference between a Freud's and a pitch, as opposed to an IMG or an X1X, isn't it? Is that the agency, like Pitch or Freud's, is an advisor. It's an objective advisor. And that's why you can come up with creative solutions that are powerful for those particular clients. And that is what an agency should do, really. But you're absolutely right, Rupert. Agencies have stopped being agencies. As soon as you start getting into rights holding and ownership, you stop being an objective advisor. I hope you're enjoying this episode of The Line. If you'd like to be involved in future episodes, either as a guest or as a sponsor, then drop me a line on danny.rogers@haymarket.com or look on the PR Week website for details.
So welcome back. Now, we've been talking with Henry Chappell and Rupert Pratt about agencies. Let's talk about Facebook. Friend or foe, Rupert?
Foe, ultimately. For the sports industry, because they've done a fantastic job of monetizing the sports industry directly without actually having to pay out for any rights. So, great model. And, it's been interesting to see how so many rights holders dived into building up their social media followings as a means of, monetizing their own assets and building up, digital inventory. Then to suddenly realise all they're doing is growing Facebook's coffers, so to speak. So clearly now the next thing is, well, as a rights holder, how do I directly monetise my digital platform? And so, I don't really see Facebook. I know everyone's talking about Facebook coming in and making a major play in the rights market, but they will only do that if they absolutely have to, and I think that's a long way off.
Yeah.
They put a bid in for the IPL, that's right, isn't it? Quite a significant bid, but a long way off what the actual rights went for.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting argument, and again, using that as context, I think probably rights is a sprat to catch a macro for them, so they might be making tactical investments, whether that be to the Indian market. Might be a totally different market. So maybe they just need to grow themselves in India, and obviously cricket's the way of doing that. Is that because they're trying to become a broadcaster? No. Is it, they might make tactical investments around growing certain audience shares or as a means of creating other content. But, to shell out significant money for broadcast, they just don't need to do it.
Yeah. Well, it's hard enough getting them to pay tax, let alone pay for sports rights.
Exactly.
Henry, at Facebook, what's your view?
This is in relation to the sports industry as a whole.
Yeah.
In the first instance, I disagree, Rupert. I think they're a friend, and I think you have to look at what they have done for the sports industry as a whole. Not just them, but the social media platforms in terms of building global fan bases, driving engagement with sport, and helping, to drive people to interact with different football clubs and sports rights holders on a much, much more frequent basis, driving that obsession. And it's worked very well for both sides. And to say that all that the sport's done is built Facebook's coffers, well, of course, Facebook have done tremendously well about it because they're just, they absolutely kill the monetization because they ultimately own the customer when you kind of go through them. But indirectly via B2B transactions, sports rights holders all over the world, but particularly things like Premier League football clubs, have done phenomenally well on their commercial deals off the back of
their content engaging with consumers around the world. You look at Richard Arnold and his sales pitch for Manchester United, which has been around about Manchester United's content is the most engaging content in the world, bar none. And that's why you, Chevrolet, should part with £45 million a year to sponsor us. Of course, the broadcast sponsorship gives them huge exposure around the world, but the digital aspect of it helps to give some real empirical data behind it and prove the level of engagement. So I think, plus, I think it's really helped fuel the marketing of these sports for the broadcast, international broadcast deals. And again, that's why NBC have invested in the Premier League, and it's working for them because in America, they can activate it so successfully with the clubs, you know, with the social media channels. And so I think you look at it more broadly, and I think you know, social media has taken the sports industry as a whole about five steps forward.
Yeah, which is why Facebook is positioning itself very much. It's on the charm offensive at the moment, isn't it? And I agree with your points, you know, on that. There are means of assisting rights holders to promote themselves to new audiences.
Now, you know, when you are, you know, the rights holders or you're Ronaldo or Neymar and you've got 90 million followers on Instagram or, well, particularly the football clubs, you go, hang on a minute, we're putting all of this content out there on the channels and we're not. So now, I think they start to scratch out, and I think that's where, you know, the conversations will be had and they will look at it. But you know, then not all of the sports rights holders have put everything out. Say Manchester United don't have a YouTube channel, for example, do they? Because they believe that cannibalises their own platforms like MUTV and so forth. They were also quite late to the party with some of the social media channels. Their strategy was just to wait and listen, believe that when they came to the party that they could build up their audience pretty quickly and do it on their terms. And so, I think it's going to be interesting moving forwards, because I think, yes, I think I'm saying up to now, I think moving forwards, and this is very speculative because no one knows what Facebook is going to do about bidding for rights or whatever. None of us know, right? So,
they've got to decide pretty quickly with the next Premier League, right?
I think it's too soon. They ain't going to do that. I think that's down the road. That's not going to happen.
They need to.
I think Richard Scudamore needs somebody to push up the value of the rights. Somebody to. But I think it's probably a bit sooner. I think obviously Amazon seems to be more likely with the Premier League when you talk about that particular example. Mm-hmm. But you know, again, I think they can sit there and watch a bit. I think, can't they? I mean, it might be too soon for Amazon, because Amazon's deal with the ATP is quite a significant one, and they've probably got to onboard that and make that work. Perhaps I don't know, but no, it's certainly they're looking at it. Of course they will. As businesses of their scale, well, there's a lot of test and learn, isn't there? And that's the way the business, you know, certainly a lot of Silicon Valley business, they do. They'll look at things and see what happens.
The Line, where sport meets the marketing business.
The big difference between a Facebook and a normal sports right holder surely is that Facebook hasn't got a subscription model. So how does it make the payback on those rights?
Yeah, no, exactly. I think, you know, you've got to compare Facebook and Amazon in terms of their business models. I think, to Henry's point, Facebook lends itself to promoting and growing a sport, which is why they're positioning themselves as the friend of rights holders, you know, short form content, highlights, fantastic for sports fans, but also non-live content, so viral clips, videos, all the stuff that we PR these days, so great for that. You look at Amazon subscription TV model.
Yeah.
Do I want to watch live sport on Facebook? No. Do I want to watch it on my giant TV screen on Amazon? Yes, so that the hardware is there. Again, they can monetize it through the subscription model, but also I think for Amazon, sport is a sprat to catch a mackerel. I think the end goal for Amazon, let's just remember what Amazon is, you know, it's an e-commerce platform, the most successful e-commerce platform. So for them, they're looking, thinking, well, hang on a minute, you know, before you know it, you'll be buying the boots they're wearing, you know, Amazon will be delivering the beer and the Pringles to your home at halftime, because Alexa will know that you've run out because you'd have told it. It will know that you've...
You're selling this future to me.
Exactly.
It'll know that you're going to mow the lawn afterwards.
Have me on Pringles.
You know? So I think the interesting thing for me around sports broadcast and OTT and players like Amazon coming is the e-commerce model. Because, again, going back to that tangible monetization, what's the end goal for any brand? Is to sell more product. And to sell that as directly as possible, which is why data was the new oil.
Yeah.
Because it was a direct monetization means. But you can't get much more direct than click and
The tipping point, I think, will come with one of the global, genuine global rights holders, which is because HP has done to an extent, but it's, we're talking about football or basketball, perhaps selling their rights on a global basis. You know, and it may not be football because it's more difficult, because obviously the Premier League is very in a very competitive environment. It doesn't own the sport. It might be more a sport like, well, the NBA, because obviously the NBA own basketball.
Or a tactical investment within the NBA as a means to create content. So if you think of a portion of, so it might be Thursday night football, NFL or whatever it might be, buy up a small portion of rights to create an anchor destination. But then it's no coincidence that Amazon are building content around Man United. Why? It's much harder to you don't shop while you're watching live sport, do you? Let's face it. And same for
Chelsea,
Facebook.
Chelsea fans do.
You don't surf.
They've got nothing else to watch.
You can in NFL or NBA. There's massive great gaps in the action. Yeah, exactly. Right? Well, that's the American market. You can't do that in football.
Facebook are busy monetizing outside of the live sports performance. Again, for Amazon and Facebook, we're creating other content, which where they can be a bit more disruptive in terms of that commercial play.
Right, talking of big sports rights holders, we're going to finish off talking about Formula One. I've not been as interested in Formula One since
Nigel Mansell.
Yes. This has been, I'm not a huge fan of the sport. I don't watch it, but off the track, it's been quite an interesting year. Henry, what's your take? What's going on with Formula One?
Quite a lot of huff and puff, but doesn't seem to change much, does it? I think at the end of the day, the core product is in need of serious reshaping somehow, because it's, I think for many people, it just leaves them very cold. It's all very well to be a sort of technology race, and that's kind of interesting to a certain, but you see what's been the success of and a property like the Premier League is the drama, the human interest, the pantomime villains, it's almost like the more you've had, the Eric Cantona's, the Luis Suarez, the bad boys, the more it's compelling viewing, isn't it? It's a bit like EastEnders, the more you've got bad characters like Dirty Den or whoever, the more you want to watch, and it creates that. Whereas if it's about making a car go 0.00001% quicker, that's only ever going to appeal to quite a particular audience, isn't it? And I think they need to trade out from that somehow. And to do that, they need to build on the personality side of it, I believe. Because I still think people still want to watch humans doing amazing things. And that's the bit that's challenging for them. Obviously, they've rebranded. They've come up with a more modern, cleaner, new logo, new identity.
I love a logo story. What do we think of the logo?
It's no more better or worse than the old logo.
Bernie didn't create it. That's the main thing,
just,
isn't it?
Yeah,
it
was a case of just repainting the stand.
So it's about eradicating the sort of
Bernie.
It's a statement.
The Eccleston era is over. I think anything with Bernie's stamp on it is probably in the bin. That's not necessarily the right strategy to go down, but clearly that's probably a bit of it, isn't it? But they have done interesting things. I don't know if you're before the British Grand Prix, they did a big activation in Trafalgar Square in central London, which as a rights holder they paid for themselves, which is not sustainable. They can't do that every year. They need that to be funded by partners and activated, but they're obviously looking to do significant things. But I still think at the heart of it, you've got to get your product right. You've got to get, and I think that is got to be built around making, people give a shit and care about whether the drivers win or don't. And I think that's the problem. Do you really care?
It limits the opportunities for brands as well, because it's so one-dimensional that if you haven't got the personalities, how can the brands activate? How can they get involved?
Yeah. And that's what the teams obviously own, the drivers, and they earn so much money. It's difficult there. So I think also, they brought the Premier League into the Premier League. When Sky first broadcast the company, they zoomed right in, didn't they? So for the first time, you saw fat characters up close and personal. And I think that sort of helps. So I think the televising, somehow you've got to bring to life more the personalities around it. But it's hard because they're in a car with a helmet on their head. Mm. So
I think the big difference is, looking at Formula One is, It's a great example of what's wrong with a lot of official sport and official rights. I think the interesting thing about what's going to happen with Formula One is the US sports model is around putting the fans first. So I think that's going to be a good thing for Formula One. They're going to have to reimagine it a little bit and put the customer first. NFL, NBA, first question they ask themselves, what the fans going to think. So I think that's going to be great for Formula One to some degree. I think, you know, Formula One, much with a lot of sport these days, has become so sanitised. Are fans interested in the official content? Yeah, of course, live, the drama of the Premier League. You know, that's the destination viewing. But outside of that, do you go to your club's, Chelsea's website for your Chelsea content? You don't, do you? And I think there's a big thing around, and particularly again going back to the context of this conversation around where the industry is, official rights versus unofficial rights, particularly in the content world, unofficial publishers. I work with Snack Media. They've got 300 platforms. They're all unofficial. So from a sponsor advertiser perspective, it's a dream because we can produce content that fans are actually genuinely interested in.
Well, in that very seat, we had Robbie Lyle of Arsenal Fan TV, which I think, you could argue is the sort of standout media platform of the year, really. I mean, it's, and I'm not sure, it's interesting in terms of how you apply that model to other sports. And obviously we've seen, you mentioned Copper 90 and others have come out with what do you do? The basic premise is what you do without any rights. That's the sort of, and you've got the ambushers mentality, haven't you?
But it also comes down to putting the fans first, which is something that you brought out, Rudy.
Yeah, and personality. Sport's about personalities. There's some of the stuff that Henry and we've touched on. So the fact that, let's use Formula One as our example, let's go with that. The fact they've embraced Hamilton because he's a personality, good boy, bad boy. We know that's what sells, personalities on the pitch, off the pitch. It's rights holders. I gave you an example of I was talking to an agent the other day, and one of his players has got a column in a national newspaper. By the time that's got through the rights holder's press office, it's just not worth reading because it's been sanitised so much, versus going onto an unofficial content platform like Robbie, who actually will give you dish the dirt, will tell you what he thinks, will give you the transfer rumours. And I think that's a big issue back to the start of our conversation that our industry's got to grapple with.
I think Formula One needs to behave a bit more like a contender brand.
Yeah.
In their sport, they are the elite, the pinnacle of it. But they are not competing with their own sport. They're trying to compete with many other forms of sports and entertainment. And I think they've got a great history. They should play on that. Of course they do. They have got some great personalities within the sport. But I think they need to behave a bit more like a contender brand to get people to sit up and take notice and what have you. So they clearly got they've got some ideas. So it'll be interesting. I think you can't really judge them on 1 year until they've got a new identity because they want to have a clean, new, fresh look and feel. I think you have to sort of judge them over the next couple of years to see whether they've made a significant change. I think it's not going to happen overnight, and let's see. But
I wanted to ask you about Formula E on the end of this conversation as well, because I know Jaguar Land Rover are fairly heavily invested in Formula E, and of course it plays into the car manufacturer's desire to turn over their fleets to.
I think that you just identified what they've got, which is many sports rights holders would love to have, which is they have a higher purpose.
Yeah.
Yes.
So yes, they're sports entertainment, and yes, the nature of the things they can create events within cities, which is much more preferable. But most of all, they have a narrative, which is about their big ticket dream, I guess, is that trying to change the way people drive in cars and people's attitudes towards sustainable vehicles. So to have that higher purpose makes them much more, it's a much better starting point for a conversation with commercial partners. And it's more palatable perhaps for a younger millennial consumer as well, all of whom, as we know, are like to be associated with things which are kind of have a cause or have a good feeling about them. And I think that's quite an antidote to Formula One, isn't it? So I think that's definitely Formula
One. Potential for growth there, you think?
It's a good potential for growth. And I think Formula One needs to be conscious of that, about the fact that they've got a contender brand that actually has got a bit more of a wholesome and sort of palatable, story about it.
It's an interesting point about purpose. I mean, you've seen Toyota sign a big deal with the IOC around broadening, trying to move beyond being a car category and into a mobility area. And obviously the future of the car is there. So again, the brand purpose argument is an interesting one because it can get very dull and worthy quite quickly, can't it?
It can, but I don't think
you
they.
Still
I, don't,
need
I still,
excitement.
Yeah,
I still
exactly.
Need to watch.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go to Formula E and think.
No, but I don't think they ran it down
the
throat. But it's just nice to have that as a backdrop, and I think that certainly works for commercial partners. I think they've got a very good way of commercial model because it's like a good thing for them to be associated with. It's not the thing to lead on driving consumer engagement, but it's a sort of secondary thing that helps support it. But I think you know.
I think your point about F1 is one where when you're at the top of the tree, your contender argument, it's very easy to get lazy, isn't it? And other people are innovating around them. Formula E being a great example of addressing an agenda point and very, very neatly. But the issue with innovation, it's very easy for people to copy quite quickly. So again, I wouldn't be surprised. As soon as Formula E becomes a threat, which it rapidly is, a support they'll have a Formula E support race. They might even buy Formula E. I mean, who knows? Right. They're already making inroads towards hybrid engines and technology. It's a bit like Facebook. When they need to make that move, they'll make it, and they'll move with a big check, and they'll move fast. And again, it's just that case of they've just been a bit lazy and not innovated and not thought about higher purpose and agendas and what fans think.
So we have gone from Henry selling United We Stand fanzines outside Old Trafford through to unofficial content online. So it's sort of back to the future. Fascinating stuff. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dan, for your company as always. Thanks to Rupert Pratt, founder of Generate and co-founder of Snack Gaming, and Henry Chappell, founding partner of Pitch Marketing Group. Deo Adonai was our producer today. This has been a production with PR Week and Cake. So till the next time, thanks very much.
The Line is sponsored by Cake, the Havas Sport and Entertainment Agency.